Music in the Catskills, Sunday afternoons at 1 on Radio Catskill.
The most familiar theme of British and Irish folk song is the maiden ruined by a man who won't take no for an answer. On the next Wagload of Monkeys with me, Graham Rice, here on Radio Catskill, we'll hear songs about ruined maidens. So join me, please, on Sunday afternoon at 3.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org, and from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill, public radio for the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Listen local.
Good morning. Welcome to Catskill Character. I'm your host, Donna Fellenberg, and my guest today is, amongst many things, the owner of One Grand Books in Narrowsburg, New York, and the host of Shelf Life right here on Radio Catskill, Aaron Hicklin. Aaron's backstory is what compelled me to want to have him on my show. He's the son of a Jewish mother from Bath, England, who, against her parents' wishes, married an Iraqi Jew who then moved them to Israel for a year and then picked up and moved again to the Bahamas, where they lived on a houseboat. And Aaron's father worked as a croupier. And that's just the short version of the start of a very exciting and ever-evolving life. There's a lot to talk about, so let's get to it. Aaron, welcome to Catskill Character.
Donna, it's such an honor to be on the show.
Oh, please.
No, it's a complete highlight. I'm so unused to being on this side of the microphone.
Oh, it's great.
I'm nervous as hell, but I'm looking forward to it.
Me too. Let's take a deep breath. Okay, we'll start. First of all, I spoke very briefly about your parents' unlikely marriage, but it didn't last long, and your parents broke up when you were 6, right?
Yes, much to my mother's humiliation at the time. She had to return to England with her head in her hands to face the "I told you so" from her mother. So I think it was a pretty traumatic moment for her to have to sort of return and say, "You were right." No one likes to say that, and she had to say it, unfortunately.
That's terrible.
Yeah, you know, my father, who's no longer alive, was, you know, he was a very handsome man, but he was also a gambler, and he was a womanizer. It was a sort of classic lipstick on his collar situation. Mm. Actually, lipstick on his collar. She would see it on the shirts when she was doing the washing. And there's only so long that any self-respecting woman can take that.
Yeah.
She was 17 when she met him. He was on a dance floor in London. It was the swinging 60s. Perhaps that's not the place to meet your future husband, on a dance floor. In fact, I think he was making eyes at my mum's sister initially. That's one of the stories. My mother's actually writing her memoirs, and I am urging her on. I know she's got to the section that deals with her elopement with my father and the sort of subsequent events. So I'm waiting for her to hit send on her email with that attachment.
I'll be reading that book.
Thank you.
Well, then your mother married an Englishman when you were 9. And you said you had a very English childhood from then on, living in a village in Wiltshire. Please tell the listener about kids stuff. I love this. I love this because it's not only illustrative of your early love of journalism, but also what your stepfather offered as a parent, which was in sharp contrast to, shall we say, the parenting style of your father.
Mm. So I want to set the picture a little. I mean, this is a small village in a very rural, but compared to America, not that rural. nothing is that rural in the UK because you're always close to a major city. But it's thatched houses. It's a river running through the valley. It's church bells in the morning. It's, you know, a town where you have to get the bus to go to school. And there's very little to do if you're 12 years old, which was the age I was when my parents, my stepfather and my mother, purchased a manual typewriter for me as my Christmas present. I was the Jew that enjoyed Christmas. And the first thing I decided to do with that manual typewriter was create a magazine. I called it Kid Stuff. I ended up not typing up too much of it because I was a very slow typist at the age of 12. Yeah, one finger at a time, fingers and thumbs. My mother typed it. My stepfather photocopied it secretly at work. I produced that magazine for 3 years every month. I had a few comrades who pitched in. They would write columns or short stories or poems. We did all the things that I thought you had to have in a local newspaper, a police column where I'd get the local policeman, the bobby, to write down, you know, to send in a column on local crimes, which usually amounted to sort of missing milk bottles on the doorsteps and things like that. A bird watcher's column, a brief history of our local building society, which is sort of like a bank. In the brief history turned out to have 10 chapters to it, which I wrote for 10 issues. Very boring. Very, very boring. But I would sell it in the local stores and to local ladies who would, you know, fish out 10p from their handbags and usually a couple of candies. And
didn't your stepfather help you deliver it?
He didn't help me deliver it, but he photocopied it.
He photocopied it.
He was the, you know, in a sense, he was the angel investor because he was giving me access to something that I couldn't have afforded. I wasn't earning any money at the age of 12. I would deliver it, hand deliver it around the village and sell it in the local stores. And I would get the local stores to advertise for like, you know, £10 an issue or something. So I kind of learned all the rudiments of publishing as a 12-year-old.
Okay, so at 12, we've established that you already knew that you wanted to be a journalist. A lot happened. You lived on a kibbutz in Israel for 6 months and came back a Zionist. Of course, you were young. This happens. You went to university in South Wales and then on to Edinburgh, a place you dearly loved. What was it about Edinburgh, Scotland?
Well, first of all, it is the most magnificent city. I mean, it's sort of compared to Athens because it's built on seven hills. It has this incredible Georgian architecture. It's laid out on a grid, which is very unusual in the UK. It's not, you know, we don't have anything like Manhattan there in terms of that sort of grid formation of streets. It has an old town that is completely Gothic. It has a castle at one end of the Royal Mile and a palace at the other end of the Royal Mile. And so you will sort of walking on air the whole time. It's a navigable city in that you can, you know, walk from one side to the other in, you know, in half a day. It has beautiful parks. You're near the ocean. It has a famous docks, the Leith Docks, which is where a lot of Train Spotting, the famous drug novel by Irvin Welsh, is set. And I just loved it. I was straight out of university. I was reviewing the Edinburgh International Festival, or the Fringe Festival in point of fact, for a local magazine. And, you know, I'd been a closeted kid at university, hiding my sexual orientation. And Edinburgh was the place where I got to explore that and own that. And that was also a big part of the love affair I had with that city.
Right. That's going to inform how you feel about the place, because you could finally be you.
I could be me. Yeah. And that was very exciting. It was a different time. We're talking about the early 90s. You know, things were beginning to open up if you were gay and living in the UK in the 90s. You know, we were post Margaret Thatcher. And, you know, I remember, for example, there was a bar in Edinburgh. I'm trying to remember the name of it, but let's say it was very much of a kind that you would have experience through the 60s, 70s, and most of the 80s with a peephole, no windows. They would, you would knock on the door. They would check the street to make sure there was nobody, no roughs around who were going to beat you up.
Like a speakeasy.
Like a speakeasy. And then they would let you in. That was kind of exciting. But within a few years of my arrival in Edinburgh, that place. They knocked down the walls. They put up huge windows. They turned it into a panini cafe. It was still a gay cafe.
Aww.
And I felt that really epitomized this change in the fortunes of the LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
From people who were invisible and hidden to people who were very much in plain sight.
Mm. So as a journalist, you've certainly been exposed to a lot of trauma. The trauma of war. You covered Bosnia. I'm sure we didn't mention that, but I'm mentioning it now.
I did.
The death of Princess Diana, which was, you know, how traumatic was that?
Mm-hmm.
But you always kept working, sometimes doing many things at once. Do you think that your unconventional upbringing and the trauma that you were exposed to through your work, do you think that it affected you to the good as well as maybe the not so good? But I'm more concerned with how did it affect you to the good?
I don't know. I always had, I mean, what we call a work ethic. And I mean, that goes back to creating kid stuff when I was 12. I mean, I also had lots of jobs around the village. I worked for the local butcher. I delivered the evening newspaper as well as my
own magazine. This is what I mean when I say you do a lot of things at once, even back then.
Yeah, my family are always complaining, and my husband in particular, that I always take on far too much. And it's something I've never learned to change that. And maybe I don't want to. I do think that there is a danger of diluting the quality of something if you're trying to do too much. So I'm always mindful that sometimes something has to wait. I can be late in delivering a story. If I'm writing something for a newspaper or magazine, you know, I have another magazine now, which I publish twice a year, called Grand. It's sort of an offshoot of the bookstore. You know, and sometimes the winter issue would just become the spring issue. Mm-hmm. So I'm not great on deadlines. I need an editor to make me deliver something on time. But I do take on a lot. I don't know if it's connected to trauma because, you know, covering something like Bosnia, of course it's traumatic, as was the funeral of Diana. And I've covered other traumatic things. But there's also an adrenaline that you get from experiences like that. And it's not to minimize how awful those stories are, how horrendous it is to be in a hospital in Sarajevo or in Tuzla in Bosnia and have a doctor pull back the bed sheets of a young girl and see that she has no legs because she's been the victim of a blast, of a bomb. But the mind goes in strange places. And what happens is you write like the wind. There is something that guides your hand in extreme circumstances where you feel the story is writing itself. And I think I've had that over and over again, where I've been privy to something very dramatic, but also weirdly exhilarating. And I think it's that sense of living in the very nucleus of life, of, you know, where life and death situations, they kind of really, I don't know, they really draw you to another level. They raise your game to another level.
Mm. So I guess you've answered my question.
I'm realizing I haven't answered your question.
No,
at all,
I think you have. I think you have, because what you're saying is that helped you to be able to do exactly what you just described, to raise your game to another level.
Yeah. I will say that when I got back from Bosnia, and I would hate to take credit for something that I didn't really experience for too long. I was really there for a matter of weeks. I was in Sarajevo. But when I came back, I remember there was a period where I just felt very empty. And the emptiness was a combination of sort of delayed trauma, I think. And also, everything else seemed dull by comparison. Mm. But I remember saying to myself, I can't go back to that war until there's something positive to say. Mm-hmm. And it was a very conscious kind of sense that there was nothing else for me to say if there was nothing new to write about other than more trauma,
right,
more injury, more death, then I wasn't going to go back. And there are journalists, I think, the real foreign correspondents, the ones that really cover war, where it becomes a fix. They can't do anything else.
Yeah, Sebastian Younger talks about that.
Yes. Yeah, I think all of them have that kind of experience. So I wasn't ever there anywhere like that long enough for that experience. But I also didn't ever want to be in that headspace of having to have that sort of drip feed of adrenaline to make me produce.
Well, I was going to talk to you about how you came over to the United States, and that was of course, you got a job offer from Bob Guccione Jr., not Bob Guccione Sr. Let's make that distinction. but we've run out of time for the first half, so we'll try to get that, squeeze that in the second half. But we're going to take a break, and I have to tell you, I'm so glad you crossed the pond.
Thank you so much.
And landed in Narrowsburg. You've been listening to Catskill Character with today's guest, Aaron Hicklin, author and owner of One Grand Books in Narrowsburg, New York. We'll be right back.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Another way to help us bring you the news is donate a vehicle you don't need. Car, truck, motorcycle, you can donate to this station and it could mean hundreds of dollars of support. Thanks.
We accept any vehicle, running or not. Donate your car, boat, or motorcycle at WJFFradio.org.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, the economist and social critic Glenn Lowry has led a remarkably turbulent life. In a new memoir, he has revealed just about everything.
My affair with my best friend from boyhood's wife. How to make a crack pipe. I know a little bit too much about that.
Confessions of a Black Conservative. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Catskill Character. If you've just joined us, I'm Donna Fellenberg, and I've been speaking with Aaron Hicklin, journalist, author, and host of Shelf Life on Radio Catskill. In the first half of the show, Aaron shared stories about his upbringing, the child of an English Jewish mother and an Iraqi Jewish father, his early life and living in Edinburgh, Scotland, after university, where he began his professional life as a journalist. Let's get back to it. Aaron, I know you've told me you're a, and this is your word, fanatical reader. You always have a book with you. I'd love it if you would share the story of your mother gifting you a book entitled The Lost Language of the Cranes by David Levitt and what it means to you now.
Yes. Well, let's paint a very quick picture of a teenager growing up in the 1980s in the UK. Unlike the sort of literary landscape of today, there were really very few reference points for someone who was struggling to figure out their sexual orientation. I would say next to zero. And one day my mother comes back from essentially a yard sale. She was always going to yard sales, bringing back books from the bookstall, and said, I found a book for you. And it was called The Lost Language of the Cranes by David Levitt. And it's a book about a young gay man in New York, living with his mother and father, who comes out. And he comes out at the same moment that his father comes out. My mother never said anything else about it. She never said, like...
Just handed you the book.
Just handed me this book. You know, and I don't think the English are particularly good at introspection. And I didn't spend much time thinking about it or what it meant. Until much later, when I realized that my mother was saying in that one gesture so much more than would have been possible if we sat down and talked to each other. Mm. A, I wasn't ready to talk.
And she wasn't either, apparently.
And I don't think she was either.
No.
You know, when I finally did come out, I did it by writing her a letter and mailing it in the village post box. Because I'd gone home with that, you know, with that purpose in mind. I'm going to come out. It's going to happen. Couldn't bring myself to do it. Wrote it in a letter, posted it in the mailbox. So, yeah, I think, you know, I am a writer. Sitting down and having these conversations has never been easy. And it still isn't, actually.
Mm. I think this is a movie.
I think that movie's been made many times over. I don't know if I have anything to add to it.
No, I think you do. So... We didn't really talk about it in the first half because we ran out of time, but let's just review quickly why you left Edinburgh to go to New York City with the offer from Bob Guccione Jr.
The world is large. Edinburgh was small. I loved it, but I was in my 20s, and I just felt that my next step as a journalist, as a reporter, was to go to a bigger city. It was either going to be London, which is, you know, if you work in the UK in the media, London's where you end up if you have the opportunity. And instead, New York came knocking. I met Bob Guccione Jr., who had created a magazine called Spin and was creating a new magazine called Gear, directed at men. This was the era of what we now call sort of lads mags, sort of beer, babes and cars type magazines. Not my kind of cup of tea at all. But I liked Bob Guccione Jr. He'd been to Bosnia himself when he was editor of Spin, and we bonded over that experience.
Oh.
And at the end of this dinner, he said, I want you to come to New York and be one of my editors on this new magazine. I thought I'd hit the jackpot. I took the train back to Edinburgh, handed in my notice, and I was in New York about 3 months later.
You are a man of action. Make up your mind and there you go.
I think actually I can be quite indecisive, but that wasn't a difficult one. I think I knew I would miss Edinburgh because I had loved it so much.
Yeah.
But I was also in my 20s and I thought, you know, Edinburgh's always going to be there for me. And, you know, my father had come back. My womanizing father had come to New York after my parents separated and opened restaurants, one on Bleecker Avenue, one on Lexington. And in a very, you know, powerful way, I saw myself as sort of following in his steps. It was about as close as I could get to him. I had been over to visit him when I was 19, not that many years before, really, within a decade of me moving there. So it was very, the streets were very present with him for me.
So I just want to just very quickly talk about the jobs that you had. So you were at Gear.
Yes.
And then you went to Black Book.
Yes.
Then you were editor-in-chief of Out Magazine. And probably most importantly, you met your husband in New York City. That was the that was the highlight.
Yes.
And then, of course, like so many of us who have come here, who've lived in the cities or in the suburbs, you began to crave nature. I guess it harkens back to Wiltshire. It's kind of beautiful little village.
Absolutely.
And although you visited your in-laws in Equinox frequently, you stumbled upon the magic of Narrowsburg and what almost sounds like a fairy tale. Would you tell the listener?
Yes. So I grew up in the countryside, as I mentioned earlier, very much in the same landscape as Watership Down is set, Wind in the Willows. All of that was sort of around me. In fact, Watership Down, the author of Watership Down, lived a few villages away. I interviewed him a couple of times. And I really missed that. You know, New York is a lot. And I really wanted to find myself back in that kind of landscape. And Ilya, my husband, who I had met in 2000, not long after I met him, I got the introduction, the formal introduction to his parents, my in-laws, at an Indian restaurant in Manhattan. And then I was invited upstate to Equinox to stay at their country house. They now live there full time, but at the time it was a weekend house. And I wouldn't say this is at all like England. It's much wilder. You don't see bears walking through the woods in England. But there was lots of things that did remind me of England. And it was just so magical in more ways than I can describe. You know, just waking up and even now hearing the peepers at this time of year, the bird life. I mean, hummingbirds we don't get in England, you know. It was kind of incredible. So I knew that when I wanted to open a bookstore, it would be in this part of the world.
And 3 months after you found Narrowsburg, which was at a tree lighting ceremony, right?
Yes, yeah,
on the holiday deck there, which is
so magical. The holiday tree lighting ceremony, the tree all lit up, people drinking mulled wine, all the stores open. I thought I'd wandered onto a set, you know, from a Hollywood 1950s movie.
Right. So 3 months after that, your mother-in-law, Hannah Maritz, called you and said, you know that little store you were looking at with the bears, the guy who makes those beautiful bears? That store is vacant. It's going to be vacant.
Yes.
And then you said, And what did you do?
I called up the landlord. I put down the deposit very quickly and opened a store.
The thing I love about your store, I mean, I love a lot of things about your store, but the concept, you have to tell the listener about the concept and where you got it.
Okay, so I grew up listening to a lot of BBC radio, which is what you do in the UK. And there's a very successful show. It's still running, something like 70 years on after it started, called Desert Island Discs. A lot of famous people, every prime minister, Hollywood actors from the 1940s, they go on that show and they pick their 8 favorite songs. And then they get cast away to a metaphorical island where they get to take the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and one book that they get to choose. And that was the seed for the idea. I thought, well, what if I built a whole bookstore around the idea of Desert Island Books?
Brilliant.
Thank you.
And it's worked out so well.
It has. You know, I was able to marry my time as a magazine editor with my love of books. I had a Rolodex of publicists and agents, so I could reach out to actors, directors, artists, fashion designers, just people that I had, whose paths I'd crossed or whose publicists' paths I'd crossed more often, and ask them to create these lists of 10 favorite books. And I'm still doing it 8 years on.
That's incredible. Do you think you're going to run out of people eventually?
You can never run out of people.
Well, we have to mention, Aaron, that in 2018, you started the Deep Water Literary Festival.
Oh, yes.
And it's about to happen again in June. Please tell the listener about that.
Yes, I wanted to create something that would celebrate literature in Narrowsburg or in this region. And the festival, which is in it's technically only its 4th year because there were 2 years out for COVID. The festival started in 2018 with a marathon reading in multiple locations with many readers, from Mark Ruffalo to Dylan Baker to various authors of The Odyssey. And we did it all over town over 3 days until we finished the book. And it was a new translation by Emily Wilson. We followed that up with Grimm's Fairy Tales, last year with Frankenstein. We don't do the marathon reading anymore, but we use one text as a kind of centrifugal force for the festival. This year, it's the work of George Orwell, and I'm very excited. We have George Orwell's son participating. We have Rebecca Solnit at the festival. We have Jad Abumrad, who created Radiolab, doing something with his 14-year-old son on Father's Day, which is June 18th. We have a lot of great local author events. The Yarnslingers are doing something based on the theme of hunger, which is a tribute to Down and Out in Paris and London, and on and on and on. It's all at deepwaterfestival.com.
Fantastic. I'm going to be there.
Thank you. Please
sure.
do. Yeah, the more the merrier.
Well, you know, I have to tell you, what a contributor you are.
Thank
You're
you.
A contributor. You've been a contributor your whole life. And it's just incredible. I've really loved getting to know you. Thank you so much for coming in today.
Donna, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
This has been Catskill Character with today's guest, Aaron Hicklin. Just Google Aaron Hicklin to find out more about this incredible man, including the names of the books he's written, which we didn't mention. Excuse me for that. Catskill Character is on every Saturday at 11:30, except the last Saturday of the month, when Greg Triggs takes to the airwaves with Travels with Triggs. It's all happening here on Radio Catskill. I'm Donna Fellenberg. Thanks so much for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
As rainbow flags decorate cities across America for Pride Month, we'll celebrate with a rainbow of reading recommendations. I'm Kai Wright, and on the next Notes from America, we're making a genderqueer summer reading list with your help. Join me live to share your suggestions and learn about some great gender-affirming books to add to your collection. Sunday evening at 6, live on Radio Catskill.
Radio Catskill is partnering with StoryCorps for One Small Step, an effort to remind the country of the humanity in all of us. I'm Isabel Braverman, and we are pairing up strangers in the Catskills in Northeast Pennsylvania to have conversations, not debates. Get to know your neighbors. Let's take one small step away from division and toward each other. Sign up at WJFFradio.org.
StoryCorps is one small step, and the radio station hubs are made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Radio Catskill. WJFF Jeffersonville. Listen local.